whenever you're ready to be on. Okay. You ready to go?
I am.
And so your first question is?
Could you tell us your name and how did you become involved in the Countryside Conservancy?
Okay. Well, the name is Darwin Kelsey, and I'm the director of the Cuyahoga Valley Countryside Conservancy. Cuyahoga Valley Countryside Conservancy is our full legal name, but we sort of go by the or do business as Countryside Conservancy, because actually, even though we got started to work primarily with the park here in the valley, a lot of our work now is outside the valley. So we actually work in about a 16-county area, but we got born to help the park figure out how to rehab and revitalize the old farms still surviving within the park. You know, when the park was established in 1974, there was a long history of the folks working to get a park and hoping that if one were established, it would do something to prevent the disappearance of the rural landscape and rural character of the valley. Well, that was a nice idea, of course, but the truth is there was no tradition within the Park Service of ascribing worth or value to things agricultural in the same way that the Park Service has ascribed value to, say, wilderness or seascapes or battlefields or rich white guys' houses, all those cool things. The first couple of decades, there was very little progress made on actually doing that. The first two generations of park managers here were people trained in wilderness management, and they didn't have a whole lot of enthusiasm for old farms and old barns and fences and so on. They saw them as things that ought to be gotten rid of and let the place go back to wilderness. But you know, a few years into it, some of the founders, Congressman John Seiberling in particular, sort of got the park superintendent by the scruff of the neck and said, hey, wait a minute, that isn't what we had in mind. So, you know, by the early 80s, they were at least looking at what was left and beginning to inventory what was left. But the truth is, there wasn't much progress in saving or rehabilitating. And it wasn't until the third generation of park managers, John Debo and his associates, that it was taken seriously. That's not to say they had much luck for the first decade, his first decade of working here in the valley didn't produce a whole lot more success. And it, of course, it wasn't just their fault. I mean, it's not just that the Park Service had no tradition relative to agriculture, but when John and his staff began to reach out to other people, it's not like they found lots of able supporters either. You know, the agribusiness types were pretty much disgusted with these tiny, dinky, dumb little old relics of the past. They weren't enthusiastic about spending money or helping to rehab them. And then you've got some folks at the other end of the spectrum within the environmental movement, small but noisy minority that look at all forms of agriculture as pretty much the same, inherently evil, nothing you'd want to see in a national park. So They didn't really get very far. And then in 1986, John went to England on his sabbatical and spent a lot of time studying the British National Park System, looking at what they were doing. And much to his surprise, he discovered that about 10% of the English landscape actually falls within the boundaries of a national park. And about 90% of that's in farming. So he's scratching his head and saying, wait a minute. How come we can't do this in America? How come I can't get this done in my park? Well, he came home and was complaining to various people, and a mutual acquaintance said to him, well, you probably ought to talk to Darwin. And he said to me, you probably ought to talk to John. And so in the late 80s, and actually we got together for a really serious conversation about his rural landscape problem in the January of 98. And, you know, he was wondering if there's a fix. And I said, I might not have said yes to you 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, but here we are at the end of the 80s, and we've got 20 to 30 years of the organic agriculture movement and the sustainable and alternative agriculture movements under our belts. And their ideas are a lot sharper and crisper than they were not so long ago. And there's a network of people out there to draw on that didn't exist not so long ago. So I think we could put together a concept that would really work here in the park, that would allow us to get real people on real farms doing real farming, and at the same time respect all the traditional values of the Park Service relative to preserving and protecting the historic, scenic, natural, recreational values of the valley, which is what the Park Service traditionally says they do. That's how they frame the mission of most of their parks. So I said, I think we can do that. So he said, well, get something on paper and we'll talk about it. So I went back to my kitchen table. I was director of Lake Farm Park then, up in Lake County. And so 3 months later, I came back with this concept, and he and I and the staff discussed it for a day. And based on those conversations, I went back and did some more refining for another 3 months. And then we got back together and discussed it again. And we thought it was something that we could do, ought to do. And so we decided to go ahead. And then the question became how.
So in the how part of the question, what does it look like, the farmers working with the National Park Service? What does that look like?
Well, first of all, yeah, I'll back up just a little bit before I answer your question directly. And that is to say, what we decided to do is to create a partnership, a three-way partnership, that would bring together the Park Service on one hand. And we decided that, well, first of all, John wanted to know, would I be involved in doing this? And I gave it some thought and ultimately said yes. But the question was, should I just be a Park Service person, or should I become involved in creating a nonprofit that could be a partner that would work with the Park Service? And the thing about a nonprofit partner is that they can do a lot of things that the government can't. We can escape all kinds of red tape that they have to deal with by law. And we also can seek funding that they can't. And so we decided to go that route, and I worked to get a nonprofit established, and you know, all the legal mechanisms that are involved there. And I wrote a couple of grant proposals to the Cleveland Foundation and the Gunn Foundation for additional support. So we got the money. So there's two of the partners, the park and the conservancy. Well, the third partner is obviously the farmers. Those are the folks that we ultimately need to get back on the land and doing something. But that's not the easiest thing in the world to do. First of all, we had to sort of figure out what is it that we're going to do. We had a lot of complicated tasks at the beginning. One of the first things we had to do is what I describe as inventorying the dead carcasses of old farms to see how many body parts could be stitched back together. And because they were, the old farms are in tough shape, badly decayed. Houses are gone, barns are gone, fields are gone, fields are overgrown. You know, it is, so describing them as dead body parts is pretty appropriate. And we inventoried the dead carcasses of about 85. And that was what was left. you know, a century and a half after there began to be farms here. At the beginning of the 19th century, when people began to move into this part of Ohio and began to move into the valley, and they began to settle the valley, then you go from a landscape that, you know, had agriculture in the years 700-800 with Native Americans, but not European Americans until the early 19th century, and not many. And then throughout the 19th century, their numbers continued to grow, several hundred. By the end of the 19th century, there were probably somewhere over 700 or 800 farms, small farms in the valley between Cleveland and Akron. So you move into the 19th century, and America's changing radically. America's urbanizing and industrializing. Agriculture is industrializing or getting bigger, and it's moving to other parts of the country. And some of the things that are beginning to happen cause the kinds of farming that was being done here to really struggle. So in the 20th century, you began to see a decline of what was an increase in the 19th. We don't know how many were left by the middle part of the 20th century, but it surely was less than half than what had been here before. And by the time that the park was formed about 25 years later, you can see why, you know, there was this anxiety or angst about preventing the disappearance of the rural landscape character. And I should say, I don't think it, on their part, it was about a romantic pining for a lost world. I think they clearly perceived something very valuable, very fundamental about our society was disappearing. And it was something not to be welcomed. It was something to be worried about. And I think that's what they were after. So however many there were left, it's got to be, I would say, a couple hundred. But by the time, 25 years later, we started out, as I say, we were sort of looking at the bits and pieces, what was left of about 85 or so. We thought at first, naively, that we might be able to salvage 30, 35. 5 years into it, and we looked at how badly the body parts were decaying, we began to say 20, 22, maybe a couple dozen. And 10, 12 years later, we're saying we'll probably get to 13 or 14 in terms of farms that are actually operating again as individual farms. We started that inventorying process in 99 when the Conservancy was created. Now, 12 years later, we have 11 farms operational. We'll have two more that we'll offer for long-term lease this summer. And probably one more in 2012 or so. After that, you know, we'll take some of those body parts that I was talking about, those fields that don't have houses and barns and outbuildings and things, and we'll use them for other things. What we call production and demonstration sites and education centers and so on. So we'll create other things. But the model of an individual or a family living on an old farm, a rehabbed old farm, and doing real farming, you know, that's probably going to top out at around 13 or 14 places.
So people are actually living on the land and working?
Yeah, they are. And since the audio here can't pick up video, I don't know that it does any good to show you the some of the things that we've got, the pictures we've got.
Sure. I mean, yeah.
Well, it might stimulate your questions. So, well, this thing that we're looking at is called a request for proposals. This is the legal document. This is the tool that we use to offer public property to private individuals to make money on. So this is this land, this park land, belongs to we the people. And we're offering this to private individuals to make money. Well, obviously there's some catches and responsibilities. But what we do is we issue a request for proposal, and any citizen in the United States that's interested can compete. And it is a competitive process. And typically when we issue one of these, we'll talk to 250 to 300 people who think they might be interested and might even want to do a proposal. So they read this document. It sobers most of them up, but not everybody. 30 or 40 will still say that they're going to do a proposal and set out to do one. And half of them will get something done. And half of those are pretty bad. And we wind up with, a proposal or two or three that makes you think. But anyway, this is the legal document that we use. And what I'm going to show you is a map of the valley and where those parks are and what they sort of look like. And that may sort of stimulate your thinking. So here's a map of the park. The park is 22 miles long, 33,000 acres. And as I said, at the end of the 19th century, there were 700-800 farms in the valley. They're gone. Most of them are gone. And we think we have the potential to rehab and revitalize 13, 14 or so, plus some additional land in other uses other than what we think of as a classic family farm. So what you've got there, you can see from the map where they're located, from the north end of the park to the south end of the park.
When we talk about the boundaries of the park on the north, we're talking about what is this area?
This here is Cleveland.
Cleveland, okay.
Yep. And that little mark, that little symbol on the map, shows a farm that we offered in 2009, uh-huh. And that's in Valley View. That's the most northern park. And we already have one established that rehabbed and a family in there, and also in Valley View. And then you go further south and you get into Brecksville. We have a couple farms there, and then get down into Boston Heights and Boston Township. And then you get even further down in here into Cuyahoga Falls, where the other farms are. And one of the other things I should say is that in addition to the old farms, in 2004, we established a farmer's market here in the park. It was the first in a national park. And we've heard rumors of two or three others around the country, although when I was trying to find a couple of them last week, I couldn't. There's one in Golden Gate Park, but it's not on parkland. But so anyway.
So you think that's unique to this national park?
Oh yeah.
Is the farmer's market?
Well, it's certainly the first one. Mm-hmm. Golden Gate's got a farmer's market within the boundaries of their park, just as we do. Mm-hmm. But it's not on parkland. In fact, ours wasn't originally. It was on a privately owned farm. 2 years ago, we moved it to the park's main festival field, called Howe Meadow. Where it is, still is. So, and as you can see here, these are some of the farms. This farm was the first one, Graysland. I happened to live there. I told the park that if I was going to come and be responsible for guiding this project along, I needed to live on one of the old farms and put myself through the same misery that everybody else had to go through. Live with all the same crap and red tape and headaches and deal with the same kind of problems. What do we do with wetland buffers? What do we do with riparian buffers? What kind of fences are acceptable in this context that are modern and functional but still retain the aesthetic feel of an earlier time or aren't that bad an affront to it? So anyway, that's what I did and have done since. That's what that place is about.
And you're raising
meat goats. And that was one of the ideas there, you know. I mean, it was to make a point. This is a marketing opportunity. Way back then when I did that, most people, most Americans weren't aware that about 90% of the world's population eats goat meat on a regular basis. About half or more of the red meat consumed on the planet is goat meat, but that's not the world most of us know. But if we have 120-odd ethnic communities here in Northeast Ohio, that's a marketing opportunity that most of these people come from goat eating culture. So that was one of the things I did. But then the other farms you see in our first round, one of them planted a vineyard, built a winery. Another one started a vegetable, intensive vegetable operation. And, of course, he has chickens and turkeys and eggs and so on, too. And so, and then we went on, you know, in succeeding years. Actually, we got interrupted. We no more than got this first RFP out, and we discovered that, well, there was a change of administrations and the outgoing administration, presidential administration, decided to adopt a new approach to doing environmental compliance. And it became clear that the new set of rules were going to apply to all the parks in the Park Service. And we were going to have to do a full-blown environmental impact statement that is much more complex than anything we'd ever done. Well, that shut everything down for 4 years while we did this massive study. So $500,000 and 4 years later, we were able to go ahead with what we had decided to do. But that's not to say that it was wasted. We learned a lot. We did a lot. And it put us in a good position to just deal with all kinds of issues because we had truly done our homework on that. So, and then we offered the next round. And on board comes another three farms. CSA, a pick your own. You know, the CSA is a community supported agriculture where people buy memberships in the farm's operations. So, and then they show up once a week for the growing season and they go home with a big bag or basket of food.
So, you've been farming in the valley for how many years? Your whole life? Were you born here, raised here?
Oh, no. No, I grew up in northern Appalachia on a small dairy farm. And after high school, I went to a junior college and got an associate's degree in electrical technology. And then I got hired by the Atomic Energy Commission, was trained as a nuclear reactor operator. And I did that for a couple of years and decided that wasn't me. Okay. And then I thought I'd go back to school and get a degree in history and teach history in high school and help kids figure out what they were going to do with their lives. So I did. And then I got a master's degree in American folk culture. And in that, my master's thesis, I worked a lot on rural life and country folks, and particularly traditional ways of working with farm livestock and the traditions that New Englanders and people in North, in New York had brought with them from Europe. And then I went to work for a large history museum in Massachusetts called Old Sturbridge Village. And I went there to help them start their historical agriculture program. And I don't know whether you've heard the term living history farm. Well, the first one that was operational in America was the one at Sturbridge, and that was my baby. I went there in 66 to start that. And in 70, it was online. So, and, you know, and that was the beginning. There are over 300 around the country now, most of them associated with historical villages, living history villages. So that's where, I sort of got into this working with the public and trying to get modern urban, suburban Americans to think about where their food comes from and how that impacts the world around them. And so I was there for 15 and a half years, and then I went to Kentucky to become director of the National Scouting Museum and did that for 7.5 years. And then this place up in northern Ohio in Lake County got a hold of me to ask me to come and consult on a project that they wanted. They thought they wanted to do a historical village and living history farm. So they had a half a dozen of us from around the country to come in and critique their ideas. And I was just one of them. The difference was that everybody else loved their ideas, and I sort of dissed it. I said, why do you want to do this? It's been done. You know, if you've got 300 and you got a dozen within a day's drive, why don't you do something that's never been done, that needs doing? So, and their response was, well, what would that be like? And so I began to describe something that I sort of thought of as a cross between a zoo and a botanical garden and a science center and a history museum, and said, you know, why don't we create a place where we can get people to come and see how people in the past, through the centuries, have worked with land and plants and animals to grow things on purpose to feed us. And so they said, put something on paper. So I did. And 3 months later, we came back and discussed it some more. And I went off for another 3 months. Same pattern that I used when we were just developing this program here in the national park. And they liked it. And they said, let's do it. So we set out to create this thing called Lake Farm Park. And that's where I was for almost 10 years, give or take a couple of months. That's where I was when John Debo asked me to come over here. And, you know, I mean, the living history farms, you can do certain kinds of things with. They have certain strengths and weaknesses. That, his farm park, there are things that you can do there that you can't do with living history sites. And there's still things that you can't do there that you might want to do. And one of the things that intrigued me about coming here was to get real people on real farms doing real farming and get the public engaged.
And so this is your first experience, really, with having a personal farm, the goat farming that you're doing.
Oh, no. Like I said, I grew up on a dairy farm.
Oh, okay.
In northern Appalachia.
Okay.
But I mean, I was ecstatic when Dad said he was going to sell the cows. Why would any sane person want to stay on the farm? But a few years later, you know, you begin to think about what that was and the other alternatives and modern urban suburban life, and it begins to look better than it does when you've come out of that as a kid. And you want to do what everybody else is doing, that is escape the farm and live a normal life. I mean, when Dad said he was going to sell the cows, I mean, that meant I could play football and baseball and stuff like that after school instead of coming home to milk cows. So, but when you're away from it and you looking around about what's happening in an urbanizing and industrializing society, some people, an introvertish academic type like me, may very well start thinking about that and what that could mean, which is what happened to me. So that's what took me to Sturbridge. That's what took me to Lake Farm Park and, you know, brought me over here. So when I had a farm of my own when I was working at Sturbridge. Yes, that was my day job, but I bought a farm and lived on a farm myself in Connecticut, just a few miles away. And I raised livestock there, rare and endangered breeds of livestock. And actually, I raised animals for the museum because they couldn't produce everything they wanted. And I was into that in a way that most people weren't. And I knew what they needed. And so I could do that because I had the technical knowledge to do it. So, you know, even though I went away from the farm for a while, I came back to it. And then when I was in Kentucky, as director of the Scouting Museum, one of the things that I discovered about myself was that I missed being around farms and farmers. And so even though I continued to be a museum person, a museum manager, at the Scouting Museum, and then when I came to Ohio, I was back in a subject matter that really mattered to me, and I thought should matter to my society. And when I decided to come over here, that's still very much a part of me and who I am. And as I say, I don't see these farms as much about the past as they are about the future. I think they represent a future that we have to put in place. That, you know, I was talking about when the valley was settled. Well, you know, when the valley began to be settled, about 9 out of 10 Americans were directly involved in raising food for a livelihood. That's what people did. A century later, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, it was down to 4 Americans in 10. In the 1900 census, it's about 40%. Well, a half century later, 1950, back when my hair was dark, it was about 1 American in 10. And now, another half century's gone by, my hair's white, but it's less than 1 American in 50 that's directly involved in farming. Farming is gone. We used to eat food that was grown nearby, whether we grew it ourselves or got it from our neighbors. But now, farm food is grown far away. Food production's moved south and west into different hemispheres. And here in Northeast Ohio, for example, now we spend $8.5 billion on food every year, and we don't grow 1%. Well, supposing we did. I mean, there's an opportunity. And there's reasons that we should. You know, the food that we eat, the food system that we have, most of us perceive as giving us a food supply that's abundant, cheap, and convenient. And it is convenient. And it is cheap for most of us. And it is abundant for most of us. 1 American in 10 doesn't have access to food, which is kind of obscene in a culture as well off as ours. But most of us, when we think about food and want food, we know that whatever we're imagining, we can go to McDonald's for, or the grocery store for, or even a ritzy restaurant for. And that's not true in the rest of the world. But the food that we have doesn't come without side effects that are pretty negative. The food that we can get from far away is visually beautiful and perfect. Might not taste so good. It might have inferior nutrition compared to things that were around a half century and a century ago. It might be grown by a system that sort of ruins rural communities, pollutes rural communities, abuses the workers, and on and on. So there's a whole series of additional things that are wrong with it. And the truth is, a lot of this stuff is not going to be able to be sustained. We're not going to be able to keep growing food the way we do, long-distance industrial food, without cheap fossil fuels. And there's a good debate about whether we're going to continue to have cheap fossil fuels. We're not going to be able to do it without an interstate system that isn't crumbling. 60% of the fruit and veggies, nuts that we consume in America is grown in California's Central Valley. Well, if the interstate system isn't there, if the bridges across the Mississippi aren't there, we're all going to be real hungry real quick. They have a quake out there this afternoon. We're going to be in chaos. You know, most of our breads and all our cereals and grains, that's all grown on plains between the Dakotas and Texas. And that's dependent upon the Ogallala Aquifer, which in the last 20 years is about half gone. And scientists tell us that in another 20 years it's going to be all gone. Well, then what? So we're up against realities, you know, apart from climate change, where there's all these other specific real things that are going to happen. And we will change the way we grow food again. Or, you know, we'll have suffering that none of us are used to ever imagining. So that's got to happen. And for some of us, we see these little farms here in the park as part of this newly emerging awareness that we will have to remake North America's food system. And individually, they ain't going to feed America. They ain't going to feed the folks in the valley. But they're part of something that's starting to happen, that has to happen. And they are important because of that.
So what you've said is you're doing this work because of your concern for where farming and where food source is going in this country. In that context, can you give us a story or some memory of farming that sort of ties that together for you?
Well, I suppose that, I mean, for me, I've had a glimpse of the world where food was still, to some extent, grown in community, where people really sort of saw themselves as part of a community, part of working together, living together, depending on one another, and really being committed to their families, their neighbors, their community. And see, I believe that what we're talking about is a kind of agriculture that's not so independent and easily dismissive of place, locale, community. We've been taught that the only thing that really matters is cheap. I can get it easily, and it's cheap. And nothing else matters. It doesn't matter that all of those side effects that destroy all those things happen. And I remember seeing that to a degree, not to the degree that existed before I was born, but I still saw some of it. And I don't believe that we're going to bring the pendulum back. It's never going to swing back where it was. We're never going to go back to a food system that isn't part of a global economy. But we are going to have to go back to a system that is more respectful of place, more respectful of community, more respectful of region. And you know, we talk about local food systems. Well, what does local mean? I don't think it means 5 blocks or 5 miles or 50 miles. I think local is about relationship. It's about community. It's about people caring about themselves, about their neighbors, their friends, their family, and being committed to one another. that's really tough in our day. I mean, theoretically, that's the heart of at the heart of religion, and all of the religions that we commonly think of, you know, what we normally think of as America's main religion, primary religion, largest religion, Christianity. Certainly that kind of stuff is supposed to be at the heart of that. What most of us don't get is that we all have a second major religion, a secular religion called progress. Of course, progress has a trinity just like Christianity does. Science, technology, the market, which all work together to push friend, family aside. But it's there. And it informs all of our thinking, all the time. You couldn't do a lot of the things that we do if you didn't have some of the, if we all weren't operating unconsciously with some of the assumptions of science. Now, I always think of myself as a scientist, and I believe in science, but there are parts of it that are a true crock. you know, if we didn't make certain assumptions that are derived from science and the scientific method, which permeates all of our thinking, we wouldn't think about animals the way we do. We wouldn't treat animals the way we treat animals. You know, we raise billions of chickens, 9 billion chickens a year here in America. We raise hundreds of millions of cattle and pigs. And we wouldn't do it the way we do it if we thought of them as animals instead of production units. You know, if we lived in a society that perceived them as somehow like dogs and cats, we'd lock up all those people that are raising animals that way. If anybody got caught treating dogs and cats the way we treat our farm animals in a modern confined animal feeding operations, they'd be locked up immediately. That's just the way it is. Well, maybe we'll wake up. I'm not sure we will. Maybe we'll move in that direction. Maybe this thing that I'm talking about will help move us in that direction. But culture change is hard. It's slow. And we'll see about how we get there. Now, I didn't give you the the kind of anecdotal story that you asked me about, but but whatever.
Can you talk? I mean, I think you've really talked about what the Countryside Conservancy is doing with local farming and described the offering.
Well, that's part of the stuff we're doing.
Okay.
You know, the Conservancy was born, conceptualized and born to work with the National Park Service to help them figure out how to rehab the old farms in the park. But we knew that it would get beyond that. These farms don't exist in a bubble. Just like the farms in the valley that emerged in the 19th century and declined in the 20th century, that was a result of forces beyond the valley, beyond the region, beyond the nation. And these farms today are going to succeed or fail because of many forces that exist beyond the valley, beyond the region, beyond the state, beyond the nation. And so we knew that we were going to wind up doing things that would try to link them into what was happening and support them and protect them from what's happening out there. If it's bad, we protect them. If it's good, we link them in. So the farmers market was our first step in that direction, and to create a vehicle for them to help market their product. But there weren't enough of them to do anything that anybody would want to come to, like a farmer's market. But it was a beginning. And when we did that, that was, there were only about 15 farmer's markets in Northeast Ohio in 2004. Now, 8 years later, there's over 70. So the times, they are a-changing. In some ways, for the better, I think. So we did that. And then the Center for Farmland Preservation in Northeast Ohio saw what we were doing and saw that maybe being part of us was a better fit than being part of the organization that they were linked to, Soil and Water Conservation, Resource Conservation District. So we absorbed them, and that got us into the whole issue of farmland preservation in a way that we had never been outside the park. First, it was 12 counties. Now we're dealing with 16 counties. Why? Because there is a movement in Northeast Ohio to view Northeast Ohio as an economic development district that involves 16 counties. So I see this as economic development. It's a lot of other things, but it's economic development too. You know, if we expend $8.5 billion on food and don't grow 1%, here's an opportunity to grow 10% or more, or 20% or 25%. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of jobs. So it's economic development. So that sort of led us there. And then we began to come to terms with what's it going to take? Well, I did a bunch of research and guesstimating, try to figure out how many farmers we'd need to do 10%. Well, I came to the conclusion we'd need 8,000 new farmers that we don't have that can do what 9 out of 10 existing farmers can't do. Well, that's interesting. How do you do that? So then we began to try to figure out, well, what do they need to get going? What do they need to get started? If you're going to get started, you need access to land. You need access to money. You need access to production skills training. You need access to business skills training. You need access to infrastructure. And so the Conservancy began to say, wait a minute, we got to connect the dots. We've got to start doing what we can do to work on all of those. And so we began to do things like we took the New England Small Farm Institute's new business short course curriculum and brought it to the Midwest, brought it to Ohio. And for 5 years now, we've been offering Exploring the Small Farm Dream. Is starting a small farm business right for you? So we did that. And so we offer it twice a year, and it's sold out every year. So that's the other thing we do. Now we've just begun to develop another business, a curriculum called Your Farm Business. And we've got 9 different classes in that curriculum that's as good as anything available in the state to help farmer wannabes figure out, how do I do this? You know, how do I get access to land? If I don't have $1 million to buy land, are there alternative ways to secure land? Can I lease it? Can I rent it? You know, and there's a dozen ways to do it. So those are the other things that we're doing. So we see ourselves as trying to create these several things that will allow our society, our culture, to begin to support the remaking of agriculture in this region, or really it's the remaking of the food system. I mean, that's really what it's about. Food is like air and water. You either have it or you die. You breathe, you drink, you eat or you die. And it's, that's why the food supply is really important. And making certain that we have access to it is really important. Talk about a matter of national security. You know, that's what it is. So we're into all these kinds of things. And, you know, we're going to get into things that we've cared for. This next decade, decade two, the Conservancy will get into things that we've carefully avoided for 10 years. You've heard me describe what it is we're engaged in, what we've been engaged in. Well, that's a bunch. And in fact, we're a pretty weird organization in that respect. You know, most organizations deal with one or two of these hot button issues. They're into great food, or they're into health and wellness, or they're into social justice, or the environmental pollution, or, you know, it's one of those. And we're saying, yeah, but they're all related. So we've been dealing with them all. But notice that I've carefully avoided something because it was just too much to take on. We don't do anything with K through 12 education to speak of. But doing the things that we've been doing, it's become pretty clear, wait a minute, there's not enough people in the pipeline. You know, okay, big deal. So 15 people sign up for your Exploring the Small Farm Dream course, and that's all you'll allow in because of the nature of the class. Well, that don't get you very far towards 8,000 people in a quick order. And the truth is, there aren't that many people out there that get it yet, that this is potentially a wonderful life and a believable, sensible, practical livelihood. And why? Because they're so disconnected. And it dawned on me a couple of years ago that where we are with this mess that I'm dealing with is not so very different than Major League Baseball. You know, you got 30 major league teams, 40-man rosters, that's 1,200 guys. How do you get 1,200 guys in the majors in a given year? Well, you start 20 or 30 years earlier with kids throwing balls around the backyard, and it's school. Now, if we're going to get anywhere, we need to get millions of kids growing stuff in a garden at home and growing stuff in a garden at school again. There was a time, you know, in the 20th century, from the teens through the 70s, that Cleveland had probably the premier school gardening program in America. And that's gone. It's defunct. Well, we got to get kids gardening again, and we better get them cooking, because if they don't cook, the connection between growing it and eating, you know, cooking's the gateway. That's where they begin to see the value. So I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. Somebody's got to champion this cause. Somebody's got to get out there and start doing something. So probably we're trying to figure out how do we conceptualize this and then how do we fund it. But I expect that's probably going to be a very big part of our next decade. But it's all part of trying to put this back into our culture and our society. And, you know, some of us are committed to it because we actually believe this blather that I've been talking about. So that's the next decade for us, I think.
Well, you have in some way or another answered all these questions on my paper. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, we need help. Send help. You know, we need...
Can you be specific?
Yeah, sure. We need people to volunteer, to get engaged all along the line, to help us in the farmers markets, to help some of the farmers to volunteer, but also, you know, go into internships and mentorships and apprenticeships and stuff like that. And then the Conservancy itself obviously needs financial support and other kinds of support from our society, our culture. Everything we do costs money. Staff costs money. We have a tiny staff. I mean, relatively speaking, there's four of us, five of us full time, and another four part timers. But the truth is, my little army's invaded and occupied more territory than we can subdue, and it takes money to grow any kind of army, including my little army, to help remake the food system. So, yeah, we need people that sort of begin to get it about the things I've been talking about, and then begin to commit themselves to being some part of it. So.
Do you have any questions?
Yeah, you mentioned the farmer's market. If you could describe what the farmer's market looks like, who attends, what's sold.
Okay, well, like I said, the market here in the park was the first in a national park. And we do another market in Akron, Spinach Stan Hewitt. We're going to be moving it closer to Highland Square this year. And then we do a winter market as well. The farms in the park, some of the farmers participate in the market, but not all of them. And then we have other farmers from all over Northeast Ohio. You know, for some of them, it's an hour and a half drive to get here, but it's a quality market. And we may try to manage it pretty carefully so that it has a good mix, blend of product, fruits and veggies and baked goods and cheeses and meats and all of that stuff. So if it can be grown produced here, it can be in. If it's not, we don't allow it in. And we try to balance it so that we have far more people wanting to get into the market than we allow. And what we try to do is to have as many people as we can to give the people coming to the market as much choice as they can have. But we limit the numbers so that the farmers that are there have a chance to succeed financially. So if we think the traffic will support another veggie vendor, we'll probably add them. Will it support another pork vendor? Well, then we will probably allow it. If not, then it's no. You know, the size of the market's grown from on an individual market day has grown from about 20-25 or less when we started to usually in the mid-40s. And our visitation back in 04 was, we thought we had a great day when we were hit 300-350 people. This past summer, you know, we were typically 900 to 1,000 or more people every day. So it's, you're seeing steady growth in our market, but that's a reflection of what's going on in society. If this weren't happening across the nation, it wouldn't be happening here. And that's the reality. Yeah, we're doing, I think, a pretty good job of managing this. But we could be excellent managers and still failing if society weren't starting to wake up. And it's a different world. It's a very different world relative to what we've been talking about than it was when we started. This began to get into mainstream consciousness as opposed to us weirdos that were thinking about it a decade ago or two or three decades ago. You know, you get into 2005, 2006, and then you get books like Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, Barbara Kingsolver's book, you know. And the mainstream media begins to pick up those ideas and begins to talk about it. And now it's out there. You've got a first lady that's got a garden on the White House lawn. And she's trying to engage Americans with the whole idea of healthy eating and getting kids that are less fat and more smart. So it's there, and it's changing. And that's why we're succeeding in our market, in part, because it's out there now, and it hadn't.
My last question is, we would love to learn more about your farm. Is there anything else you could tell us, just describing your goat farm?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I got started there in the first place, like I said, to solve some problems for the other farmers. And most of those were physical things about where do you put the buffers, how do you develop adequate buffers for wetlands and riparian areas and that kind of stuff, and fences and outbuildings and so on. And the meat goats was to demonstrate a market possibility. Okay, but I did other things, you know. I mean, I could have had, you know, an industrial breed, quote unquote, boer goats. I mean, they're a breed that of meat goat that, you know, can have pretty fast growth if you really feed them like you do other industrial breeds. But I decided to have what's called a rare and endangered breed, a heritage breed. Many of them are rare and endangered. And I've been a board member of the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy for a couple decades. And those are breeds of animals that, you know, began to disappear as in agriculture began to industrialize and animals began to be selected to be grown in intensive confinement systems, high energy input with grains that their bodies really weren't evolved to handle. And so they tended to get sick, so you feed them antibiotics and you do things like that that will shut down the infections and so on. And you can feed them growth hormones so that they'll grow a little bit faster and blah, blah. So I went in a very different direction. I went in the direction of choosing a breed of meat goat for my farm that became popular to the extent that goats are popular. Meat goats are popular in America anyway. They never were compared to the rest of the world. But when it came to meat goats in America, they were one of the half dozen breeds that were commonly used. So I selected what are called myotonic or Tennessee fainting goats. They don't faint, but they have this genetic condition called myotonia that when they're startled, their muscles tense. And so they can't run. And if they're off balance, they'll tip over. So hence the fainting. But that genetic characteristic also makes them easier to manage. And it actually helps build muscle. It's like that tensing is like, when I was growing up, there was this guy called Charles Atlas, dynamic tension, and he built muscles with that. That was, when I was a youth, that was the Arnold Schwarzenegger of our day. But it comes from tensing of the muscles periodically, regularly, and these goats do that. And so they wind up actually being a very good potential for a situation like this. And they don't have to have the chemicals and the biological things that and the antibiotics and the worming and so on that say that some of the other modern breeds do. So they're a very good ecological fit for this kind of farming. So that was another reason that I was doing it. And then I helped sort out where the markets were, who buys these. So I sold most of my goats to Hispanics. We have a significant Hispanic population in our area. And they love meat goat. And they like to slaughter them themselves. It looks like my voice is giving out. Either that or coughing.
Well, I have one more question. I've been around goats a little bit, and I know that they have personalities. Could you talk a little bit about the personality of your goats?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I'm a farmer, and farmers don't make pets out of goats, mostly. On the other hand, if you're a traditional farmer, you're probably going to relate to your animals in a very different way than most industrial farmers do, because they don't see them as animals, they see them as production units. So, yes, I do have an awareness of almost every goat, you know, and their personality. And so I'm aware of their behavior and their attitudes, and they get names because of that. You know, it's Big Red or Granny or Mary Lou. Mary Lou was named for Mary Lou Retton, the Olympic gymnast, because when I brought her home, tried to catch her, she went up the side of the barn, flipped over a fence, and I thought, good Lord, talk about athletic ability. And so she is always Mary Lou. Actually, her picture's in there. If there's a, it's not that one, but fine, there's got to be that picture in here of her running. Well, that's her. That's a picture. That's Mary Lou. But she's just part of a larger group. Well, I don't know where that picture has disappeared to, but it's in here somewhere. You would think I'd know where it was in here, wouldn't you? But maybe it was in an earlier version. Yeah, I can't find it. But I look at them and yeah, you know, there's this personal thing between me and the individual animals. And I know the ones that I'd like to smack in the head, and I know they deserve it. They don't get it, but they deserve it because they're mean, and they're mean to others. And then, you know, there are others that are just, you know, really pleasant, and they're nice, and they're cooperators. But, you know, goats are like people. You know, you got goats that are got to be boss, and they've got to boss other around, bang them around, and others that are just as nice as can be. And then, you know, you get used to the goats, and you see how they deal with kids, and they help them, and, you know, the things that mothers put up with from the kids. Amazing. When the kids decide it's time to eat, and they go and butt their mother in the udder, and you know, and you say to yourself, why do you put up with that stuff? Smack them. Brats. So, yeah. But I come from a background and tradition that sees the farmer as a steward, a caretaker. Yeah, they're going to get raised to a point, and then they're going to get slaughtered. But in the meantime, they're going to be treated with respect. So that puts me in a tradition that's really quite hostile to most of modern industrial agriculture that's related to animals. And, you know, unless I re-engage my society with where food comes from and gets them reconnected to where the food comes from, how it's grown, they don't have any reason to become ticked, hacked, unwilling to accept that way of treating billions of animals a year. So, you know, so there's these things that are going on in me that, you know, I'm a pragmatist. I deal with the world as I perceive it. But there's things about it that I truly, deeply dislike.
I think that's good. Thank you very much.